Some of the views expressed on the Mormon Channel are solely for the education and inspiration of our audience and may not represent the official position of the Church.
We welcome you again to the Mormon Channel of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and our program, Past Impressions. I'm Brent Topp, the chair of the Department of Church History and Doctrine at Brigham Young University, your host, and I am really grateful today to have on our program Ronald O. Barney, Executive Director of the Mormon History Association, involved with the Joseph Smith Papers Project. And Ron was working with the Church History Department in Salt Lake City for over 30 years, a gifted historian, scholar, and very, very knowledgeable on so many subjects of church history. Ron, I'm so grateful that you've agreed to be one of our guests on Past Impressions.
Nice to be here, Brent. Thanks for the invitation.
Today we're going to talk about the 1847 trek across the plains from winter quarters to the Salt Lake Valley. We'll see how far we get in the programs that we do. And so, Ron, you're an expert and author and editor of a great volume on this subject. And why don't we begin talking about the preparation and leaving winter quarters and getting ready to cross the Elkhorn and head out. So let's just take us from winter quarters and how the Vanguard Company is organized and Brigham's vision for that.
Thank you. To begin with, I think we have to ask a question. Why did the Latter-day Saints feel like they had to go?
Mm-hmm.
Why did they move west? Why not go to the south? Why not go into Canada? Why did they feel like they absolutely had to leave? And geography plays a real role at this particular time. As you probably know, there were considerations of ventures into Texas. There were considerations of ventures into British Columbia, even discussions about the possibility of Central America, because the Mormons felt that they had to go. Well, why did they feel like they had to go? And while this might seem a little tangential, I don't know that it is. I think that while the Latter-day Saints believed in the Constitution, believed its divine implementation, that it had everything to do with creating a platform so the restored gospel could flourish in a land of freedom. When the Latter-day Saints experienced the difficulties in Missouri, mm-hmm. and Joseph Smith, in October of 1839, went with his very small little entourage to Washington, D.C., and the day after their arrival there, at the very end of November of 1839, meet with President Martin Van Buren. And in that meeting, and he's there with Judge Elias Higbee, one of the group who had been a county judge in Missouri, the reception that they received, I think, began to point to a future that the 1847 trek became a part of, because they were rebutted. Mm-hmm. The idea was to, of course, get to not just President Van Buren, but I think their main thrust was probably the Congress, the Senate, and the House. And we know a little bit about what happened. We know about their petitions, and we know how they were received, and the retort that was applied by the Missouri delegation to the allegations of Missouri atrocities upon the Mormons. They countered that the Latter-day Saints brought this on themselves, and once they were able to mount an argument that in many ways could be compelling absent a larger context of what had happened to the Latter-day Saints, the federal officials shut the investigation down. And this is after what I believe were two visits by Joseph Smith to Martin Van Buren, one at the end of November and one at the end of January of 1840, wherein Martin Van Buren personally insulted Joseph Smith to the point that he hightailed it back to Nauvoo and began to excoriate the officials in the federal government once he got home. Then there was a kind of a peace that happened thereafter. We did not continue our diplomatic forays to Washington, and Nauvoo began to expand. Immigration, you know, just in 1 year in 1842 comes to Nauvoo, and just in British converts, and we start to build and strengthen our position there on that spectacular peninsula in the Mississippi River. But then, of course, with the probably with the dual difficulties, the two entities of both internal difficulties with outside difficulties, the latter led by Thomas Sharp from Warsaw, one of my relatives actually, who wrote a wonderful volume on Anson Call, described Thomas Sharp as the voice of the anti-Mormons, and a man named Levi Williams as the fist of the anti-Mormons. And then there was the internal disruption from some of Joseph's closest associates, not the least of which was the member of the First Presidency, William Law. The Laws brothers and the Higbee brothers and the Foster brothers mounted an opposition that that really left the Saints in a position where they were going to have to make some serious decisions about their future.
Let's talk about those things that are going to drive them out of the United States into a barren wasteland of the Great Salt Lake Valley.
Of course, the catalyst that kind of became the death knell for the Saints being able to stay in their minds in the United States was what I feel comfortable in calling is a conspiracy to take Joseph Smith out of the picture entirely, with the idea that once Joseph Smith was gone, that
would just die out probably.
It would indeed.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not one who goes along with a conspiratorial idea that the federal government was involved in all of this. I think this is all just a local effort to try to bring about Joseph Smith's demise. Once that happened, and there was a brief pause of difficulty and persecution after Joseph's death, by the next fall, 1845, September, there began to be a cleansing of Hancock County. And Mormon, I'm sure this has already been discussed, but Mormons were driven out of Hancock County into Nauvoo. Finally, a delegation from the church met with a delegation from Quincy, Illinois in October of 46, and an agreement was made that the Latter-day Saints would leave. They didn't really know where. But clearly there had been something afoot about getting into the West in 18 – I said the Quincy group and the Mormon delegation was October of 46, I think. I meant 45. And at that time, there was a sense that we would get a contingent of Mormons in the West in 1846. And they had ideas of wintering at Grand Island that year. There was a sense of haste, a sense of urgency. Finally, an agreement was made that there would be the Latter-day Saints would be left alone to have sufficient time to prepare themselves so that when the water ran and the grass grew that following spring, they would en masse leave Illinois, cross the Mississippi into the West. And we've got to remember at this time that anything beyond the Mississippi was there wasn't a state there. save it be Missouri to the north. Missouri had been Missouri had been a state since 1820, but Iowa was a territory mm-hmm. until 1846. So they would be leaving the confines and protection of what we really think of as the United States. I understand that there's been discussion about the difficulties of crossing the crossing Iowa, which was incredible. Maybe it was the most difficult part.
Giant mud hole.
It really was. It took them about as long to get across Iowa, just that one state, as it did to get all the way into the West because of those difficulties. And so as they began to prepare, as they made their way across Iowa, as they made an arrangement with the federal government to be able to house themselves temporarily on Indian land across the Missouri River now. So you have Iowa that is bordered by both the Mississippi on the west and on the Missouri – by the Missouri River on the east. Or excuse me. I get those.
The other way.
Mississippi on the east, Missouri River on the west. They had a plan then to get in – to use that as a launch point. Maybe as many as 100 villages – of Mormons grew up in the western part of Iowa. And they ended up there for 5 years, from 1847 through 1852. And finally, the latter part of 51, Brigham Young gave the edict that we're going to abandon those and everybody that's in the Missouri River settlements. We want them in the West. But for a period of time, they had the look of permanency. Mm-hmm. And this was all started at the time that the saints were thinking, how are we going to get out west? Initial thoughts of thousands moving into the west eventually whittled down to – and it's a really an interesting story in itself. But they eventually whittled this down to about 12 dozen people. Hmm. And as they began to prepare over that winter of 1847, in January the 46-47, in January of 1847, Brigham Young received a revelation, not his first and not his last. This is one, however, that has been canonized, and there are parts of it that we assume are marching orders to get to the West, but in so many ways. What is now Section 136 of the Doctrine and Covenants, added to the canon in 1876, became in many ways a charter for Latter-day Israel for the future. Mm-hmm. And it the instructions that were given by the Lord to Brigham Young transcended just the movement of mm-hmm. peoples, but had very much to do with the soul of the Latter-day Saints and how they were going to maintain their soul as they contemplated their departure from the confines and the great freedoms of the United States of America there in the beginning of 1847.
You're listening to Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel. I'm Brent Topp, your host, and our guest today is Ron Barney, Executive Director of the Mormon History Association, and we're studying today the 1847 trek of the Vanguard Pioneer Company. Well, Ron, we talked about Section 136 and the mind and will of God to not only the Pioneer Company, but really the whole church. How is this guiding that Vanguard Company, and how is it kind of the marching orders, the Constitution, and much, much more?
In some ways, and it's very interesting, I believe, you can take Section 136 apart, and I'm just going to say parenthetically here, it's a unique revelation. When Brigham Young dictated this revelation, probably to Thomas Bullock, there were at least 16 copies made of this revelation. Most all of them are in Thomas Bullock's handwriting, which looks like italics, typewriting. It's so fabulous. Hmm. When Thomas Bullock came on the scene as one of the scribes for Joseph Smith, I think everybody who is a student of Joseph Smith threw their hands into the air and said, "Hallelujah, we can read this man." and Thomas Bullock then penned out this that multiple copies of the Revelation. And when one thinks, well, why would there be 16? We don't know exactly who the identities are, but the Church History Library has number 1 and then several others and number 16, which is why I'm confident in saying at least 16. And one would think that perhaps each one of the leaders, the members of the 12, would get copies. And Brigham Young, and I can just say this as a parenthetical aside, the original intent was not to leave members of the 12 behind to keep the saints faithful. The original idea was to take the entirety of the 12 into the West. Mm-hmm. This was looked upon as being a major initiative on the part of the church of establishing with some bravado that we're going out here and we're coming fully loaded. And this was not passive in the very least. In fact, there was some disappointment when John Taylor and Parley P. Pratt stayed behind. Perhaps we'll have some time to discuss Brigham Young's reaction to all of this. At any rate, in the early months, they began to prepare to assemble this vanguard, this group that was to be out front to these, in some ways, were truly called the pioneers, the ones who actually went out and do what we think pioneers do, and that is sacrifice themselves for those who come later on.
How did Brigham decide who was going to go? Remember that we'd had some problems in Nauvoo with everybody wanting to be in those first company and everybody wanting to be with the 12. So how do they decide? You say we have 12 dozen, and yet we've got thousands and thousands of saints. So how do we get to that vanguard pioneer company?
I've never been able to see anything that formalized the enlistment of these people or how it was done. In several instances that I do know of, it was word of mouth, a recommendation. So-and-so would be good for this. Their family's probably in a pretty good situation, and this particular individual is a very fine shot.
Okay.
And we're going to need hunters for this expedition. And so there were some that were selective like that. Of course, it was the book that I wrote edited, the title of it is The Mormon Vanguard Brigade of 1847, Norton Jacobs' Record. Norton Jacob was one of the rank and file who eventually became a captain of 10. I use the word brigade to try to suggest that it really was in military order. There were generals, there were lieutenants, not literally, but that's how it was organized. Right. And there were captains of 10. They didn't exactly have 14 groups of 10. It varied from 9 to 11, 12, thereabouts. But that was the idea, that there would be order in the camp, that instructions could be given, that there would be a vehicle to get the water to the end of the row. And it ended up being a fabulous exercise in that very kind of enterprise. And before I'm done, I'm hoping to be able to show the contrast to that of how military order worked versus its reversal when that first group who came to Salt Lake City returned to winter quarters, and we had quite a different venture. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to juxtapose just the stylistic way in which the that vanguard brigade was organized initially.
I find that really fascinating that you it was kind of a don't call us, we'll call you, but they did call and say, well, so-and-so. But it was somewhat who was prepared and who had the skills that are going to be able to meet this adventure. Now that they're gathered together, they've received the mind and will of the Lord for the camp and for the church. We bring these people together. Let's get them to the Elkhorn, and what happens there?
Well, of course, there is an extensive list of things that the vanguard would need, and true to form, the Latter-day Saints made a detailed record of all of this, which really adds to the uniqueness and the fact that the preparation was so significant, and they felt it was so significant that they would document the entire thing, at least the preparatory kind of venture, the listing of the commodities. They had a large group of animals that went with them, from their cattle, the horses. They had dogs with them. They had chickens. And all of these are accounted for. They had plans for blacksmithing tools, which became really one of the really essential components of the trek. And those who could wield those kinds of tools became very, very prominent. They ended up with designating about, once they got going a little bit, about 25 hunters. Hmm. And that was kind of a wonderful position to be in, because the hunters would be out on the flank of the vanguard and were not eating dust like every other person was. And there were some who kind of vied to get into that that hunter camp, and there were times when the scarcity of it allowed some folks who wanted to get into it, who were initially rebuffed, to be able to show their prowess and became part of the hunters. Anyway, all of that to prepare themselves. They initially planned on leaving the very first part of April 1847. They finally assembled on the Elkhorn River into Nebraska territory the middle of April. And it was on April the 16th in the morning that they began their venture. I'm going to read from Norton Jacob, who really created one of the finest diaries, and the fact that he writes from the position of being just one of the foot soldiers, the rank and file, adds to the wonderful account that he has. This is Thursday, the 15th, April 1847. Moved down the Horn, meaning the Elkhorn, and went up to the camp 12 miles above on the bank of the Platte. Arrived in the middle of the afternoon. Some of the brethren were engaged setting their wagon tires. Totaled 50 miles. In the evening, we were called together by the sound of the bugle when President Brigham Young delivered a short lecture upon the necessity of being vigilant, holy, and righteous before God, that we may be successful in our present mission, watching and praying continually. He then appointed tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock to meet and organize the camp for journeying, stating that when organized, the camp would be summoned to rise in the morning by the sound of the bugle, also to attend prayers, and also for the camp to go ahead. Then the next day, Norton Jacob writes, Friday the 16th, called together by the sound of the bugle at 8 o'clock, when upon numbering there was found to be 143 men, 3 women, and 2 children. We also have 73 wagons. Brother George A. Smith spoke upon the necessity of strictness of discipline in order to secure our own preservation. Well, that's how they began their venture. Organized, systematic, and this was no group that was just slapped together. Mm-hmm. They had a purpose.
You know, and I like that in that segment that you just read, that it was the purpose was not solely temporal. They understood there was a spiritual dimension to this pioneer company. And, you know, I find it fascinating that all throughout that journey, and even the journey that led them to winter quarters, they're comparing themselves to the ancient camp of Israel. This is a spiritual mission. They are messengers of God, if you will, in preparing the way for those that will come behind. And I love that statement there where they had to attend to their spiritual duties, their prayers, and to keep themselves holy. This wasn't just a group of settlers. These were a group of single-minded missionaries, if you will, in just a different kind of way than what we traditionally think of missionaries.
Very, very much so. I think that's I think that characterizes the entire operation, that this is just not a relocation to another place. And we know from what many of the folks wrote, and there were several dozen who wrote about this venture of individuals who were involved in it. They knew that there was something that they were doing that was unique and extraordinary. And so they had this sense of mission. And we'll a little bit later, we'll talk as we continue to move west, we'll talk about the times they had to be reminded when it looked like they were forgetting a little bit about what this charter for travel, this charter for this purpose in the West might be.
I think, in fact, I love the Scotch blessing at Scott's Bluff. That'll be great. Today on the Mormon Channel on Past Impressions, we've been talking with Ron Barney, the executive director of the Mormon History Association. We've been talking about the preparations for the Vanguard Pioneer Company, or as Ron refers to it, as the Brigade, that Vanguard Brigade of 1847. In our next episode, we're going to talk about the actual trek as they now cross over the Elkhorn and start right in onto that trek and some of the great adventures. And so, Ron, we look forward to having you on the next program as well.
Thank you very much.
We invite you to listen to Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.